Hello and welcome to Science World. Scientists have confirmed a 9-year-old theory that says there's a huge lake of liquid water beneath one of the moons of Saturn. The World Health Organization is trying to calm what seems to be a sense of panic in some areas about the severity of the Ebola outbreak in the West African country of Guinea. And a newly published study shows that we humans are pretty bad lie detectors when trying to tell if someone is trying to deceive us. Today we'll talk with the study's author on our one-on-one segment. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Scientists have had a hunch since 2005 that there is liquid water on Enceladus, one of Saturn's moons. It turns out that they're right. With complex measurements of the moon's gravity, scientists were able to determine that there is a body of water perhaps as large as North America's Lake Superior and about 10 kilometers deep underneath a thick sheet of ice and above the moon's rocky core. Since water is a key ingredient of life, the researchers from the California Institute of Technology are saying that Saturn's moon may be a good place to search for non-Earth life forms. The World Health Organization says the Ebola outbreak in Guinea is very serious, but has not reached epidemic proportions. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization is trying to calm a sense of panic in some areas about the seriousness of the Ebola outbreak in the West African country of Guinea. It rejects claims by the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders that the outbreak of the disease is unprecedented. WHO spokesman Gregory Hartle says there have been larger outbreaks of Ebola recorded in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. He says the outbreak in Guinea is relatively small compared to the one in Uganda in 2000 and 2001, which infected more than 400 people. 4 cases of the disease have been reported in the Guinean capital, Conakry, but Hartle says it is not unusual to have cases in capital cities.
In Gabon in the 1990s, I believe there were cases in Libreville. The same idea where someone basically was infected elsewhere and got him or herself to Libreville because of basically medical facilities being better in the capital than elsewhere. The source of infection is still quite localized in the southeast of Guinea. So for us, this fits the pattern of all previous Ebola outbreaks.
The World Health Organization says the disease has not spread to other countries. It says the 7 suspected cases of Ebola, including 4 deaths in neighboring Liberia, occurred among Liberians who traveled to Guinea and were infected there. It notes laboratory tests of several suspected cases in Sierra Leone have all come back negative. Ebola is spread through blood and other bodily fluids from an infected person. It can also be transmitted by the handling of contaminated corpses. Bats and primates are the original source of the infection. Hartle says it is essential to stop the chains of transmission.
It's a question of controlling infection in hospitals. It's a question of controlling transmission among the people who might have been infected and don't know that they have been infected yet or are not in hospitals. Hence, as always, the 2 most important things are what we do in hospitals and how we trace contacts.
Authorities in Senegal have closed the land border with Guinea to prevent the spread of Ebola into their country. Hartle tells VOA the WHO does not recommend travel restrictions, which he says do not make sense. The incubation period for Ebola can be as long as 21 days. The World Health Organization says the outbreak cannot be considered until 2 incubation periods of 42 days have passed, without a single transmission of the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The human brain contains roughly 100 billion nerve cells connecting our senses, thoughts, motions, emotions, memories, and automatic responses. A good map would help explain how these circuits talk to each other. Scientists have published 2 of the most detailed brain maps to date. Steve Barragona has more.
Until now, researchers had unraveled the complete mental circuitry of only one organism, a tiny worm with just 302 nerve cells. But one of the new studies published in the journal Nature puts together a complete map of a mouse brain. Our brains and the mouse's are remarkably similar, but with around 100 million neurons, what's inside the rodent's head is both less complex and easier to study than the human brain. Researchers at the Allen Institute for Brain Science designed a weakened cold virus that includes instructions for making a glow-in-the-dark protein.
And then we inject a tiny, tiny amount of virus into the brain of a mouse.
Neuroscientist Hongkui Zhang leads the project. She says the virus would infect a small number of nerve cells and cause each individual cell to glow along its entire length. A robot then carved up the mouse brains, one extremely thin slice at a time, and took microscope images to trace the path of those glowing neurons.
So this kind of image cut, image cut, image cut process is completely done by the microscope itself.
The complete map includes a staggering amount of data, 1.2 petabytes, or the equivalent of a high-definition movie nearly 24 years long. The map is just the beginning, however. Scientists will be searching the map for clues that will help them understand brain diseases, such as how memory fails in Alzheimer's disease.
One possibility is that there might be, you know, very specific but very fine connectional changes in a particular pathway of the brain. You know, for example, the pathway that involves memory.
The other map, published in the same issue of Nature by a different group at the Allen Institute, shows what genes are turned on and off across the brain about halfway through pregnancy. Neurobiologist Ed Lean led the group.
The idea is that we can use this map to really try to pin a time and a place where sets of genes associated with disease or sets of genes associated with unique features of the human brain may be active, and these are probably going to be targeting early developmental events when these circuits are first set up.
For instance, Lean says they were able to pinpoint a region of... where genes linked to autism were more active.
It gives us an idea of what kinds of cells may be affected by this large cohort of genes and what developmental process, but also it pins the timing much earlier. It would suggest that the origin of autism may be quite early prenatally.
Both complete maps will be freely available to other scientists. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up in a few minutes, we'll hear about a new study that shows that we humans aren't such good lie detectors. Apparently, trusting our own intuition is a more reliable method to determine someone's truthfulness, rather than looking for the physical signs we've always been told a lying person displays. So, with lie detecting in mind, for this week's Science World Quick Quiz, we want to know the name of the person who was credited with inventing the modern polygraph, one of the most popular devices that is used to determine if someone is telling the truth or not. Is it A, Thomas Alva Edison, B, John Augustus Larson, or C, Alexander Graham Bell? Good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
A UN panel says humans are interfering with the Earth's climate and that the effects touch every continent and the planet's oceans. Science World's Doug Bernard tells us more.
In a new report released this past week, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change highlighted the risks of a warming planet and said that in many cases, the world is not well prepared. It says governments need to develop plans to adapt to climate change and to incorporate those policies into their broader development plans. The report says the effects already observed include impacts on agriculture, human health, water supplies, and on both land and sea ecosystems. It says the more the planet warms, the greater the chance for severe impacts that may be irreversible. The panel also cautions that uncertainty about how severe the impacts will be and when they will hit make that planning more difficult to carry out, and that there is no single approach that is appropriate for dealing with risks across the planet. For Science World, I'm Doug Bernard.
A British research team has used 3D imaging to reconstruct the entire route of the most famous fossilized dinosaur tracks ever, a so-called chase scene that was broken up and its pieces put into museums nearly 70 years ago. Roseanne Skirbel tells us in her report that the technology gives a new digital view of ancient dinosaur history.
Our story begins along a riverbed about 120 million years ago, in the age of the big dinosaurs. A large, meat-eating, three-toed theropod races close behind a long-necked sauropod, perhaps hungry for his dinner. Their feet press into the mud as they run, and after millions of years, their fossil footprints are discovered along the Paluxy River in Glen Rose, Texas. In 1940, those tracks were sent to museums. Some were lost in transit. Peter Falkingham with London's Royal Veterinary College and colleagues wanted to put the entire 45-meter-long scene back together.
As you can imagine, a really long trackway from a dinosaur tells us a lot more than just two or three steps do.
The researchers used 17 photographs and hand-drawn maps from Roland T. Byrd's 1940 excavation, coupled with 21st-century technology called photogrammetry.
Which is where you take several digital photographs of an object from multiple positions, and the software looks for features in those photographs, matches those features, and then basically uses maps to figure out the camera positions. If we have lots of cameras, we can get a 3D model.
They describe that model in the journal PLOS One.
We can see both the theropod and the sauropod trackway coming down a trench that's been excavated out by Byrd and his team. We can see the sandbags at the end where they were keeping the river off the tracks that they were excavating. Yeah, we can basically see everything that you could see in the photographs, but now we can see it in 3D from any angle.
Falkingham says while photogrammetry is gaining popularity in archaeology, paleontology, and other fields, his study breaks new ground beyond a launchpad for future work.
What we've done here, as far as I can tell for the first time, is reconstruct something that doesn't exist anymore, at least in that form. And that's pretty exciting because museums hold tens of thousands of specimens and inevitably some get lost or damaged.
Falkingham says with photo documentation, what can follow are 3D images and even 3D printing to create the objects to study both physically and digitally. But for now, if you want to see that famous dino chase from 120 million years ago, race on over to voanews.com. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
NASA is planning to send humans to an asteroid and Mars eventually. But a group of prominent U.S. scientists say right now any deep space mission will be too dangerous based on NASA's minimum safety requirements. And engineering capabilities and the understanding of the effects of long-term cosmic radiation exposure will not advance sufficiently within the next 5 years to change that assessment. After a study of long-duration space travel sponsored by NASA, the panel of scientists from the National Academy of Sciences says that the space agency should consider ethics while designing standards for future long missions. In an open letter, they say NASA should not send humans on trips outside low Earth orbit lasting longer than 30 days without strict adherence to the existing health standards, and that the rule should be broken only in rare and extenuating circumstances. Drugs commonly used to prevent rejection after organ transplants may help lower levels of HIV, suggesting a possible new strategy for fighting the virus. Science World's Bob Doty has more.
Although antiviral therapies can suppress HIV to very low levels, they do not eliminate the virus in the immune system. Dr. Stephen Deeks at the University of California, San Francisco, says inflammation in response to the infection may allow the virus to persist. He and his colleagues noted immunosuppressant therapy given to transplant patients to reduce the risk of organ rejection also reduces inflammation. They wondered if immunosuppressants could help defeat HIV. They followed 91 HIV-positive kidney recipients for an average of 3 years. They found HIV remained well-controlled, and the patients who took the drug sirolimus had fewer infected cells in their blood. Based on those findings, the National Institutes of Health is sponsoring a study of sirolimus and HIV. For Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. A few minutes ago, we asked if you knew the name of the person who is credited with inventing the modern polygraph, one of the most popular devices that is used to determine if someone is telling the truth or not. Is it A, Thomas Alva Edison, B, John Augustus Larson, or C, Alexander Graham Bell? The answer is B. John Augustus Larson was a medical student at the University of California, Berkeley, and was also a member of the Berkeley Police Department when he invented the polygraph back in 1921. While the machine has always been quite popular in police TV or movie dramas, the polygraph's use in real life has been controversial. In some countries, such as the U.S., information produced by the device may not necessarily be acceptable in court cases. The polygraph measures and records several bodily functions, such as blood pressure, pulse, respiration, and skin conductivity as an individual is questioned. It's thought that when someone is lying, the body undergoes some stress and produces variations in those body functions that are detected and displayed by the device. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Do you think you're good at spotting a liar? Or know when someone is trying to deceive you? A new study that was recently published in the journal Psychological Science suggests that we humans aren't really that good at lie detecting. The study theorizes that looking for stereotypical tells or signs in others, such as someone averting their eyes or fidgeting while they talk, may prevent us from knowing whether that person is lying or telling the truth. According to the study, what seems to be more effective in helping us better gauge whether someone is lying or not could be our own intuition or gut feeling we may have about a person's truthfulness. The author of the paper is Leanne Ten Brink. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business, and she joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about her team's research, findings, and why we humans tend to make poor lie detectors. How poor are humans at being able to detect when others are lying to them, and why are they such bad lie detectors?
Well, there's really been mounting evidence in the field that we're really poor lie detectors, performing at about chance. So if I gave pretty much anybody a set of 10 videos in which 5 people were lying, 5 people were telling the truth, everybody would get around 5 correct, so we could do just as well if we had flipped a coin and not bothered to watch the videos at all. There's a variety of, suggestions, theories why we're very poor at this task. One possibility is that we're just not looking for the right cues. So there are cues to deception, behavioral, verbal, and nonverbal, but they tend to be relatively subtle. And so you kind of need to know what these are in order to pick up on them. And people tend to have incorrect beliefs about what these behaviors are. So if you go around the world and you ask people, you know, how do you know if someone is lying to you? They will overwhelmingly say that liars can't look you in the eye. Liars avert their gaze, whereas there's no scientific support for this notion. And so maybe it's that we're looking for the wrong things, and that is really pulling our judgment accuracy off course. Well, if you think about it, we all lie, and we all know those stereotypes. And so if you are lying to someone and you want them to believe you, you correct for those things. So if I am lying to someone and I want them to believe me, I'm going to look them straight in the eye. I'm going to avoid fidgeting so that they're more likely to believe me.
You mentioned a little earlier that regardless of the classic tales that we mentioned earlier, there are some subtle signs that we should look for. Can you tell us what they are?
Liars tend to be under more kind of cognitive load is what we call it, or basically they have some mental resources and they tend to get used up. So it's very difficult to come up with a lie. You know, you're trying to make up these details and make sure that they don't contradict things that the other person knows. You're trying to control your body language at the same time. It's a very difficult task. And so usually liars will reveal some behavior that indicates that they're mentally taxed. So this might be that they pause before answering, giving themselves a little bit of time to come up with that lie. They might engage in speech hesitation, lots of ums, ahs, and ers. So, you know, they're trying to come up with that lie and giving themselves a little bit of time by filling those pauses with noises. They might use tentative language, and they may engage in more or fewer illustrators, actually. So usually when we're speaking, we talk with our hands. You know, we illustrate our point with hand gestures. Liars tend to do less of this. One, because they don't want the hand movement to come off as fidgeting or nervousness, so they're controlling that, but also because they're so mentally taxed that maybe they just don't think that it would be important to illustrate what they're saying with their hands. So their behavior becomes somewhat constrained relative to their normal behavior. Liars tend to give you very few details because, well, one, it's very difficult to come up with those details that are false, and two, if you get to repeat it later, it's much easier to repeat fewer things than more. So that is a great way to kind of elicit more cues to deception, is just to keep asking questions, keep giving the liar more opportunities to trip up, essentially.
I'm curious, Leanne, how did you and your colleagues come up with your findings? What experiments did you do?
So we were really interested in, you know, this very consistent finding that we tend to be very poor lie detectors. And we kind of came at this from an evolutionary perspective, which suggested to us that, you know, in some situations, it would be very helpful for us to be able to detect lies. It would be great to be able to detect lies and cheats in order to ensure our ability to survive and reproduce. And we thought that maybe this skill doesn't need to be conscious. And that's where all of the previous research had been done. You know, you watch a video, someone asks you, is this person lying or telling the truth? And you make that conscious, very explicit decision about that. But in order for us to be accurate lie detectors and for that to help us to survive and reproduce, maybe it doesn't need to be a kind of conscious alarm bells that go off in our head. It could just be a feeling that you don't trust this person. You don't really want to lend them the money, or you're not very excited about going on a second date with this individual. And maybe that's enough to lead us in the right direction to avoid liars. And so we thought that maybe our ability to detect lies lives in the unconscious mind. So we went looking for evidence of that.
That was Leanne Ten Brink, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of California, Berkeley's Haas School of Business. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more, so stop by and visit us on the Internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.